Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. With me in studio to discuss an incredibly historic, really, I think is probably the right word, week for equality and specifically for transgender individuals is Sarah McBride. She is a total rock star here at the Center for American Progress and leads our work on these issues. Sarah, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me on the best trans week ever.
Best trans week ever. So why has this been the best trans week ever? Walk us through some of the big announcements and news.
Absolutely. Well, I think it's safe to say that transgender Americans have seen more progress in the last 5 days than potentially at any point in our community and movement's history. Starting on Monday, a lawsuit was filed by the U.S. Department of Justice against the state of North Carolina over their discriminatory and mean-spirited bill HB2, which, among other things, requires or bans transgender people from accessing restrooms consistent with their gender identity. And in announcing that lawsuit, the attorney general delivered probably the most profound and moving and frankly forceful speech in favor of transgender rights that we've ever seen from a senior administration official.
She went so far as to actually compare HB2 to Jim Crow laws. How did she make that comparison? Do you think that it's apt?
She did. And her way of making the comparison was talking about it was, throughout our history, we have too often sided with exclusion and discrimination. Too often in our history, we have had distinctions without a difference. And that has included signs among restrooms that separated Black Americans from white Americans. Now, obviously, no two movements and no two communities are the same. And as a white transgender person, I'm cautious in making that comparison myself. But I think her point was that saying that transgender women can't use women's restrooms and saying transgender men can't use men's restrooms, and the rationale behind that is a distinction without a difference in the same way that requiring people of different races to use different bathrooms.
And for that reason, some people in the trans community and more broadly in the progressive community are actually calling her speech the trans movement's I Have a Dream moment. Is that how it feels right now?
Well, I certainly think it's going to take a trans person to deliver our movement's I Have a Dream speech, but there's no question that that speech was not just pivotal from a sort of broader historical perspective, but also incredibly helpful and empowering for the community itself, particularly after weeks of both rhetorical and legislative attacks that we've seen in states like North Carolina, in states like South Dakota or Tennessee that tried to pass similar bills. It was truly a turning point, and it was only the start of the week. Yesterday, news broke that the U.S. Department of Education and the U.S. Department of Justice would be issuing clear and comprehensive guidance requiring schools to allow transgender students access to facilities and programs consistent with their gender identity and requiring schools to treat those students consistent with their gender identity. And then today, the Department of Health and Human Services released a final rule that interpreted the sex protections in the Affordable Care Act to ban discrimination based on gender identity and gender stereotypes, which provide incredible protections, particularly for the transgender community who no longer can face categorical exclusions for medical care around their transition in healthcare programs funded by the federal government.
So help us unpack that a little bit. We're speaking, it's Friday of this week, so folks who are listening over the weekend and in future days to come know that this all has played out throughout the course of this week. But unpack for us a little bit what you just said and what the importance is of rejecting that kind of categorical exclusion.
One of the most frequent forms of discrimination that transgender people face are these blanket exclusions that exist in insurance plans that say, despite the fact that the medical community has deemed transition-related care, that's surgeries or hormone therapy or any kind of treatment related to transitioning genders, despite the fact that the medical community has deemed those treatments medically necessary, insurance plans have historically, at least in the last several decades, said we will not cover any care related to that. despite the fact that most of those procedures, almost all of those procedures, are actually provided for other people for other reasons. And so it's a pretty clear-cut instance of, we're going to provide this service for everyone but transgender people, despite the fact that transgender people, based on science, based on medicine, based on the needs of these transgender people, need these services just as much as other people.
So I think we would be remiss if we didn't mention, for our listeners' benefit, that this is a set of issues that is incredibly personal for you. This is not just an advocacy issue that you lead on here at the Center for American Progress, but actually some of our listeners may be familiar with you, the celebrity that you are. You took a selfie that went viral in a North Carolina bathroom. It ended up on MSNBC and basically every other news outlet that was worth its salt. I may be biased, but that is my view. What was the significance of the selfie you took in North Carolina, and what is the significance of the issues we're talking about to you?
Well, I, as you mentioned, I took a selfie while using a restroom in North Carolina in a government building that I was technically barred from being in. And I took the selfie and posted it on Instagram and Facebook, and it blew up far more than I ever could have expected. I took it not because I wanted to demonstrate, oh, look at me and don't I belong in this space. I took it to try to bring some humanity to this issue, move past the rhetoric, move past the abstract arguments and the unfounded fears, and say we are real people and we need access to bathrooms. If we can't access bathrooms consistent with who we are, it becomes much harder to go to work. It becomes much harder to go to school. It becomes much harder to participate in public life. Banning people from restrooms that make sense for them effectively removes people from every aspect of society. And so I took the picture and posted a message along with it in an attempt to say, this isn't about what we look like. This is about who we are. This isn't about our appearance. It's about our humanity. But this entire issue for me and where I come to this work for me is so much more than my own identity as a transgender person. And not to get super deep, but I come to this work not just as someone who is transgender, but also as someone who's loved someone who's transgender. I met my future husband, Andy, fighting for trans equality. We ended up working together here at the Center for American Progress, and we fell in love. Shortly after we started dating, he was diagnosed with cancer. Andy was a transgender man who had come out in college. He had the courage to say to this world that says who we are is wrong, that he wouldn't spend one more day hiding. And after he received a clean bill of health, his cancer came back and it was terminal. Andy and I decided to get married in August of 2014. And just 4 days after that, he passed away. There are a lot of things that I took from that relationship with Andy and that experience with Andy. But for me, more than anything else, and this goes to creating safe schools, this goes to removing exclusions that allow transgender people the treatment they need to live true to themselves. The lesson that I took was that every day matters when it comes to building a world where every person can live their life to the fullest. And the last several days, we've seen the Obama administration stand up and come out on the right side. They've always been on the right side, but forcefully come out on the right side of history on this, and to bring equality to millions of Americans that have been excluded for generations.
Thank you for sharing what I know is a personal and difficult to share story. But I think it does provide a lot of, as you said, humanity to what we're talking about. I think from where I sit reading the news coverage, almost all of it focuses on bathrooms, right? These bills, which are not exclusive to North Carolina, which really have been spreading like wildfire across the country, and that's worth reminding ourselves about. It isn't just North Carolina. The coverage often focuses on bathrooms and often the declarations of why we need these, quote, protections for people, right? It focuses on protecting people in bathrooms. Why do you think that that's the thing that advocates of this kind of discrimination lead with?
Bathrooms have been a central component of anti-equality forces throughout the last 60 years. Every single movement for equality, from civil rights to the push for the Equal Rights Amendment to advocacy for the Americans with Disabilities Act, every single effort in part has centered around bathrooms. I think for many people, transgender people and non-transgender people alike, bathrooms are understandably vulnerable spaces. For whatever reasons, bathrooms are spaces where we feel We feel exposed and potentially so vulnerable that we feel unsafe. But what opponents have done, particularly in this fight around access to restrooms consistent with folks' gender identity, is they have said that if you protect transgender people from discrimination in bathrooms, if you continue to allow transgender people to access the restrooms they've been accessing just now without fear of discrimination or harassment, that there will be predators who will take advantage of those laws to harm women and children. This is an argument that they made against gay Americans 30, 40 years ago. It was untrue then and it's untrue now. And we know that for a number of reasons. We know that because we've passed transgender protections, including in restrooms, in 18 we have them in 18 states, and we've passed them in over 200 cities. And we have never seen an instance where one of these laws has allowed for or facilitated violence or public safety incidences in public restrooms. Law enforcement in those states and communities have come out and said that these fears are unfounded. And 250 of the nation's leading sexual assault and domestic violence organizations have come out and said protecting transgender people in bathrooms, from protecting them from discrimination, doesn't hurt anyone, and banning them from restrooms doesn't help anyone. And if anything, it only perpetuates and increases violence against an already vulnerable community.
And that was part of what Loretta Lynch, the Attorney General, focused on in her speech. She really called out North Carolina Governor McCrory and the way that he's been messaging around that particular bill, HB2. She said, "You've been told that this law protects vulnerable populations from harm, but that is just not the case. Instead, what this law does is inflict further indignity on a population that has already suffered far more than its fair share. It provides no benefit to society. All it does is to harm innocent Americans."
And it's 100% true. The facts bear it out. The reality bears it out. And the transgender community that's under attack, we're making that clear. 70% of transgender people in one study have been harassed, assaulted, or discriminated against in a public restroom.
70%.
That's an astonishing number. The people who we know are vulnerable in bathrooms are marginalized communities, including the transgender community. Predators are not going to put on a dress to access a restroom in order to commit a crime simply because we protect transgender people from discrimination. The idea that non-discrimination laws are relevant to a person committing a crime that was illegal the day before these protections were passed and a crime that's illegal the day after these protections were passed, the idea that that comes into play is completely unfounded and, frankly, a ridiculous idea.
So stepping back just a little bit and you know, perhaps reflecting on why this is a relevant conversation for a show that is called Talk Poverty Radio, how does this bear on a fight for economic inclusion and for the economic potential that trans individuals have in this country?
We know that transgender people already face incredibly high rates, disproportionately high rates of unemployment. The poverty rate within the transgender community is astronomically high. And that's a result in part of the pervasive discrimination in employment, in housing, in public accommodations, in healthcare that transgender people face across the country. The reality is already very difficult for a lot of people within the trans community. And when states and localities come in and further restrict or foster and perpetuate that discrimination, it results in even more negative outcomes, economic outcomes, health outcomes. As I said, if you can't access a restroom that's consistent with your gender identity at work or at school or when you're going out shopping for goods and services we all need to live and thrive, it becomes much harder to do those things. And at best, it results in negative health outcomes at work that will inevitably lead to less productivity, less employee loyalty, and potentially unemployment. And at worst, it keeps the person from participating in those activities entirely, which, as we know, leads to negative health and economic outcomes.
So where do we expect this lawsuit that the Department of Justice has brought against HB2 to go? There's going to be activity in the coming week. What's ahead of us and what do we expect to come from it?
I think advocates are optimistic about this lawsuit for a number of reasons. One, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals just 3 or 4 weeks ago already ruled that Title IX, the federal statute that protects people based on sex in federally funded education, educational activities, protects transgender students. So the court that is hearing this lawsuit, the lawsuit both that McCrory filed in North Carolina and the lawsuit that Loretta Lynch in the Department of Justice filed, they've already ruled on aspects of this question. And it's highly likely that they will find the same thing as it relates to employment as they already have found as it relates to students. If that happens, there's a possibility that this case is then appealed to the Supreme Court. And it's unclear whether the Supreme Court will take it. If they don't take it, the Fourth Circuit's decision will stand. If they do take it and create firm nationwide precedent that transgender people are protected under existing sex protections, that will not only have a monumental impact and effect on transgender people nationwide, it'll provide clarity for states, localities, and employers. It will also, move our country forward in another step, like the one we saw a year ago with the Supreme Court's marriage equality decision. The question, though, is how the court splits. If it splits 4-4 with the vacancy that it has right now, the appeals court decision will stand. Certainly, we want a nationwide precedent, and it is vital that we fill that final vacancy on the Supreme Court, in part because we want to make sure that there is a nationwide standard for treatment of transgender people.
So you mentioned the landmark Supreme Court ruling that made marriage equality the law of the land last year. We at the top, you described this week as the best trans week ever. But do you feel that what we've heard from the Obama administration, from Attorney General Lynch, and more broadly, this kind of set of landmark announcements and steps in this amazing direction, does all of this have bearing not just for the trans community, but more broadly for LGBT folks generally, and perhaps even beyond that?
Well, I think there's a couple answers to that. One is we have seen a lot of progress recently in with courts, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission interpreting sex protections to also include discrimination based on sexual orientation. There is no question, though, that as we firm up protections based on sex, as we continue to expand their impact to communities once excluded, that will enhance protections for everyone. LGB folks, lesbian, gay, bisexual Americans and individuals, they face discrimination not just based on their sexual orientation, but also their gender expression in a lot of instances. And so as we expand, as we interpret sex protections to include not just trans folks, but anyone who deviates from sort of gender norms and gender stereotypes, the more protections LGBT people as a whole will gain, as well as people who aren't LGBT, who do not conform to gender stereotypes in every way.
So I just want to give our listeners a chance, if they feel that this is an area and a set of issues that they don't know enough about and that they would like to learn more, where would you recommend that they go to get themselves up to speed, not just on the significance for bathrooms, but sort of the broader set of issues that we've been talking about today?
I'd certainly encourage listeners to visit AmericanProgress.org.
I'm shocked to hear you say that, Sarah.
There is a wonderful LGBT page that has resources and information on all of the issues that we've talked about. There are also great resources at transequality.org, which is the website for the National Center for Transgender Equality, which has been a leading institution on this fight. And I also encourage individuals to speak out themselves, progressive individuals, allies who may not know a ton about transgender issues. And I certainly encourage you to educate yourself. But it's never too early to speak up. It's never too early to stand up for a community that for so long has faced attacks from those who are opposed to our equality and in response so often seen silence from our allies. So I encourage everyone to speak up.
Sarah McBride from the Center for American Progress and Selfie Fame, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio. We have a great rest of the episode lined up. Up next, the news that came out this week about how Google had revised its policies about payday lending ads, and also a weekly-ish worst with Alan Pike.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Tracy Ross. This week, Google announced that it will ban all payday loan ads from its site after advocates pushed the company to address how the lending practice exploits low-income people by offering them immediate cash with sky-high interest rates. To discuss this, I'm joined by Logan Koepke, an analyst at Upturn, a technology-focused consulting firm. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So before we jump into the details of why this was a problem and what this announcement means, are you at all surprised that Google has taken this step?
I'm not entirely too surprised. We had been working with a coalition of, or we at Upturn had been working with a diverse coalition of financial justice groups, civil rights groups, media groups, and working with Google for a period of several months to sort of bring the problem of payday loan advertising, both from lenders and lead generators, which we can discuss later, and sort of bringing the problem of these ads and what consumers were facing on their platform to them. And throughout the entire process, they were very receptive. They did their own research. It was very, very thorough. So I wouldn't say surprised, but, you know, it's definitely a great move and one that the community is definitely praising and very happy about.
So I'm going to have you help walk me through what exactly the problem was. So let's say I'm, you know, like the many Americans who have a problem coming up with some emergency cash. There was a survey that said about nearly half of Americans wouldn't be able to come up with $400 in emergency. So it could be that I'm having trouble paying, you know, my bills because of childcare. All of these things are adding up. So right. I might go and do a quick search for how I can get money. What happens next?
Yeah, so say you log on to Google and you type in, like, I need money for rent. What would happen is you have two different sort of things that pop up on that search. You have your organic search results, which are sort of the rank-ordered list of websites that Google's algorithm has sort of determined are the best sites to return. And at the very top and along the right side, you also see these ads that might say, like, cash now or pay money for your rent right now. And those advertisements sometimes can look really attractive, and you can just click on them to see what they say. Especially if you're in a sort of desperate moment really needing cash for any sort of unmet need. And if you go to those websites, more often than not, those websites actually aren't lenders. They're lead generators. And what lead generators can sort of intuitively be understood as middlemen connecting consumers to the end product, which would be payday loans. So what happens is you might end up at a nice-looking website that has some comforting images of maybe a woman and her family with cash around a computer, and you sort of walk through many steps of inputting information, your name, your residence, where you work, when you get paid, your bank account information, your social security numbers, some very, very sensitive information. And then that gets put into a quote-unquote application that then is sort of auctioned live and in live time to lenders. And lenders will sort of bid on this auction to buy a consumer's information to prospectively get that consumer as a lendee.
But at this point, though, all I know is I've put in my information, and then in like 24 hours, I get the loan that I need. I get about $500,
exactly.
$400, whatever it is, into my bank account.
Exactly. And for most consumers, you know, most people don't read the fine print at the bottom of a website and in terms of use or privacy policy. Most consumers will have no idea that the website they're on is actually a lead generator and not a payday lender themselves. And maybe they don't realize till the very end where you get sort of a loading prompt screen that says, we're connecting you to a network of lenders to see who could help you out. And maybe there still isn't even a realization then that this entire process was done through a lender. And this is sort of the model of how online payday lending works. Up to around 75% of loans actually done online rely on these lead generators to really fuel their business.
And so you were walking through, my information is now is out there and there's all these different lenders bidding on it. What happens after that?
Yeah, so say what can happen is basically, say a lender, you are an individual who has never gotten a payday loan before. You're sort of a prime target for an online lender to offer you a payday loan. So they might pay top dollar to a lead generator to get your information and sell you the loan, basically, and give you the terms and then deposit that money in your account. So you could, as a online payday loan front, pay $200 for someone's information because it is that valuable to get a new consumer, because the entire business model is predicated on them eventually not being able to make some sort of payment structure or obfuscating what the payment structure is, so they're actually paying more fees than the principal or the loan eventually has to be rolled over.
So on this show, we've talked a lot about the dangers of payday loans and how, because they have sky high interest rates, you know, maybe 37% interest rates, that could just you quickly realize that a loan that you needed for a short emergency before your next paycheck traps you in this cycle of poverty. But in the report that Upturn released, you guys wrote that online payday lenders are often more harmful than their storefront counterparts. Mm-hmm. Can you explain the difference between the, I guess, what we've traditionally thought of as payday lenders that we've talked a lot on this show, and why the online market is so much more dangerous?
Yeah, so there are a couple of reasons, and I'll try and walk through them as clearly as possible. So one thing is that if you just look at one metric would be looking at Better Business Bureau complaints, which not necessarily is the best model to understand who's doing bad stuff. But 90% of the Better Business Bureau complaints about payday lenders relate to online, not storefront lenders. Another thing is online lenders can sort of obfuscate their entire repayment model. Whereas you might, if you go to a storefront, have the terms in front of you in a piece of paper, it might get emailed to you later and you don't necessarily realize what the structure or repayment terms are. There's also sort of an element involved here where a storefront is a private business that you have in your community, and there might be some level of trust because, you know, there's a physical storefront. Whereas online payday loan lenders, they could be related to, you know, they could have a sovereign nation partnership and be related to a tribal lender. They could be incorporated through an offshore corporation, sort of. And there are just all sorts of different problems here where you're just further removing the consumer from the actual company who's giving the product.
And so you have a Medium post from the fall that walks through a bit of this. And you talk about how the loans themselves are obviously a problem because they're a poverty trap, but it's also the sensitive data out there that's a problem.
Right. Yeah. So basically what happens is when you are a consumer and sort of as we were describing earlier, walking through this process, you click on an ad and you input your information. What you've done by inputting that information is you've already, at one point, you clicked a box, and that's agreeing to that website's terms of service and their privacy policy. Say it's a money mutual, for example, the company that's very notorious for the Montel Williams TV ad endorsements. If you go onto Money Mutual and put in your information, they reserve an almost unlimited right to do whatever they want with your information, to sell it, resell it, rent it to someone, that sort of thing. The privacy policies are shockingly permissive for these companies, and that's sort of their business model, is they will get paid by lenders who want your information, and then they have their information and they want to resell it to other people to continue making money off of you. So it might mean selling it to a data broker who's compiling a list of people in a certain neighborhood who are looking for financial products. They could sell it to another financial services firm, maybe like a credit reporting group or people trying to, a debt collection group. So there's this whole other ecosystem that consumers really have no insight to and is completely opaque that they've agreed to when they are inputting their all this sensitive information online.
And so, again, we were talking a bit about the difference between the storefront payday lenders and online payday lenders. How does this work if I'm in a state where payday lending is illegal?
So, yeah, that was one of the main findings of our report. There are a number of states that have basically outlawed or have exacting requirements. I think it's about 15 states that don't allow storefronts, and something like 9 to 10 have sort of very strict requirements governing the fees and repayment periods. One of our core findings of our report was that if you, for example, mask your IP address as being for a consumer from Pennsylvania or a state that has strong usury laws, we were still finding routinely ads for these payday loans, despite that community deciding that they did not want payday loans to be a part of their community. And that was sort of a troubling factor, to consistently see state law effectively being flouted by lead generators and online payday lenders by advertising to consumers and communities where their legislator had determined this is not a good product, this hurts our community and our citizens, we don't want it. But those ads were still nevertheless showing up.
So because they have your information and they know where you are, how exactly is that legal that they can say, yes, we're targeting particular people, we have this person's information, we know they're in Pennsylvania, but we don't need to follow the state laws?
So eventually what happens is a lot of these lenders will employ what I was mentioning earlier is either one, a common theme is sort of sovereign partnership or tribal incorporation. And there's a whole other body of tribal law that sort of applies there, and that becomes a very complex sort of legal question. Another tactic they use is basically a choice of law provision. So when you agree to the terms of the loan, they will say the terms basically will be controlled by the law of, say, Utah or Nevada or somewhere that has very permissive law regarding payday loans. What's interesting is there's actually been a good amount of when we were doing legal research regarding this, there's been a good number of court decisions that have not looked favorably upon online lenders who basically attempt to avoid state usury laws or regulations by employing these sort of choice of law provisions and payday loan contracts. But those are sort of the two models that these lenders use in order to avoid quote-unquote flouting state law.
So now with Google's policies, they're not going to have these ads up, but how exactly will this work? Now let's say it's July, their new policies are in practice. I do that same Google search. I need money for rent. What would the search then look like? What are they proposing?
Yeah, so we won't know the exact shape of the policy until it's released. It's not yet out there, and I'm sure Google wants to be confident in the language they put out there after they've tested various things, that they're sure that this certain language is workable. But basically, what will happen is, say you do that same search, you could get a number of certain advertisements back, but you're not going to be getting advertisements regarding payday loans. You'll still get the same, organic search results, which are just the links underneath the ads. So, if there's an upstanding potential lending unit out there that has done well enough to generate a lot of traffic and they have a good website, they might still end up as number one on the search results. And that's, those results aren't affected at all. But what won't be happening is ads for loans that are greater than 36% appearing on Google's platform.
So you would have to essentially maybe scroll through the searches to find one of those more predatory lenders.
Right. You would, you know, who knows how highly ranked they may or may not be within the search results. I highly doubt they're highly trafficked. I think you would have to really start plunging into the depths of Google to get to some of these really, really shady actors.
Now, so the Payday Lenders Association, or the defenders of payday lenders, have said that this isn't fair, that this will be to the detriment of lenders who have fair practices. Some have also said, well, you know, this is providing a service. Low-income people who need money quick are able to get it. You know, what do you think that they're going to have much sway in the debate going forward? Obviously, Google's not bending to them, but you know, search engines like Bing and Yahoo have not yet changed their practices. What do you see going forward?
Yeah, going forward, I understand where groups like the OLA can come from here. But at the end of the day, Google, from our research and from their own independent research, has determined that ads for these types of products are harmful. There is a long-standing body of research, no matter what your good best practices might be as a payday lender, that the end product is harmful to most borrowers' financial health. They really aren't the short-term solution they're ginned up to be. More than 80% of payday loans are rolled over or renewed within 2 weeks, and that is just sort of churning debt forward. And you know, the average payday loan borrower is indebted to a lender for 5 months of the year. I think it's something that like most borrowers end up renewing their loans so many times that at the end of this entire long cyclical process of debt, they've actually paid more in fees to the lender than the amount of money they originally owed. So I understand that the industry might say this is not going to discern between best actors or worst actors, but I'm still not confident what the best actor looks like in this space. The end products are just so ruinous for so many people that it's hard to see what a good actor, how a good actor could even be a good actor here. And like when you speak of sort of the best practices these companies might have, for example, the Online Lenders Alliance had, and going through their best practices during our research, they had no sort of best practice regarding the imposing a contractual limit if you're a lender upon lead generators or who you got the information from reselling them to X number of entities, which is just a very basic number, a basic number of protection, and would be a very easy consumer protection, you know, best practice to implement. So I get that, you know, some of the industry members might think this this policy won't discern between a great actor and a bad actor. And I'm sensitive to, you know, when you have a large search engine like a Google or like a Bing making certain judgments about products. But when these products are judged through rigorous and long-standing bodies of research to just not be good products and to, in fact, be harmful products, I'm okay with that judgment being made.
Going forward, are there any other ways that you and the many advocates who've been working on this are looking at how online companies and search engines like Google or others can do more to participate in consumer protections?
Yeah, well, I mean, Google is a great partner through this entire process, and I'm sure that now this dialogue is open, it will remain open, and we work collaboratively together on this one issue. So I'm sure there will be some room going forward. I'm sure that there will also be, you know, now that Google has made this choice, I'm sure that the entire coalition and broader civil rights community and financial justice community would want to see the same action from a Microsoft and a Yahoo. And it should be noted that earlier in, I think it was the summer, Facebook changed their policies as well to just flat out ban any payday loan advertisements. So it's really, you know, it's a useful sort of chorus of large technology companies making a statement saying we don't think these products are good, especially as the CFPB begins to make the final touches on whatever payday rule may come out soon. So.
And you mentioned CFPB. Do you think that there's a role for the federal government ensuring further protections as these technologies change and collect more people's data? What recommendations have you all put out for the federal government in this work?
Yeah. So this is definitely Google making this move is a great move and should be praised, but is by no measure enough. The FTC and CFPB have been active in the past in discovering lead generators at the center of sweeping financial fraud operations. You know, the FTC has sued companies. There's a company named Leap Lab that collected hundreds of thousands of consumer payday loan applications from lead generators and then used those leads to illegally debit millions of dollars in unauthorized charges. And so, you know, they've been active in ensuring to police the really bad actors. This is just going to require, you know, constant vigilance by the FTC and CFPB going forward to make sure that whatever rule is eventually promulgated by the CFPB is technologically sound and can be enforceable, especially with whatever new permutation that the industry comes up. To no longer call it a payday loan, but maybe an installment loan or something that has a new flexible, unique term structure that at the end of the day is similar to a payday loan you get online, but it's obfuscated again by certain terms or payment structures. So there's definitely going to be, basically Google's move does not supplant federal regulation of this industry. It's good to have. And the CFPB and FTC should really feel that going forward, they should be working equally as hard, if not harder, to protect consumers in this area.
My guest is Logan Koepke, an analyst at Upturn, which is a technology-focused consulting firm. Thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. And we're having a weekly worse for the first time in a really long time.
Which is why
the weekly-ish worse.
Much to Alan Pike's chagrin, when I call it weekly-ish worse, that is actually accurate. Sorry, Alan. It is accurate.
Well, I decided my new policy here is that in my reality, a week is now the period of time between whenever I get to come hang out with you guys and do a radio segment. Wait. So, like, it's starting to mess with, like, the billing cycles of various, like, practical matters
so
in my life.
And also you're aging.
I was about to say, how old are you in weekly worst years? Does that make you younger? This is like a Benjamin Button thing?
Pass.
All right. So let's get into the stories.
Keeping us on track, Tracy. Right. Thank you.
Trying.
First up, low-income people have almost no chance of getting a lawyer when they need one to fight a landlord or navigate say, the public assistance system or spar with a debt collector or anything like that. And that's because, unlike in criminal cases, where every American has a constitutional right to representation, civil court actions are a free-for-all. And while many attorneys commit their careers to providing legal aid rather than more glamorous or better-paying private law practice, the odds are still impossibly long that you'll actually be able to find a lawyer if you need one and you can't afford one. There are fewer than 7,000 legal aid lawyers nationwide, and that's in a country where, again, 110 million people are poor enough to qualify for that kind of help. That works out to one legal aid attorney for every 15,625 Americans in poverty. And that's just the nationwide average. It's actually a lot worse in many pockets of the country. For example, in South Carolina, there's one legal aid lawyer for every 40,000 poor people.
Oh, Jesus. I'm going to let my lawyer speak for me on this one.
Who's your lawyer, Tracy?
Rebecca Vallis. You have the floor.
Oh, dear. All right. Well, we'll discuss my retainer later. So, Alan, is there a particular reason that you picked this? Is there something timely, or pandering to me?
No, it was both pandering to you, and my colleague Bryce Covert wrote a really great piece about this yesterday. I guess by the time people were listening to this, a few days ago. I forget the name of the group. I didn't write it down, but there's a group that studies this stuff that puts out, I think, annual or maybe every other year statistics on that report had just come out, and Bryce wrote a really great piece about it for thinkprogress.org, which people should go read.
I will second all of that. Pandering is appreciated. Thank you. More of that.
This is a double pander. I both get to plug something Bryce wrote and pander directly to you in the flesh
and your
live
talk poverty friend
or live to tape. I guess.
But in all seriousness, I mean, I will mount the soapbox briefly before we get to the next one, just because this is a problem that has existed for decades, but it has only gotten worse over time, because not only has Congress continued not to fund legal services at levels anywhere approaching what the need would be, but people who are low income have more and more legal needs as time goes on, with the eviction crisis that we discussed some number of weeks ago with Matt Desmond and his book Evicted, with people facing problems accessing public assistance that they desperately need, whether it's food stamps or TANF, the legal problems continue to mount, but the number of lawyers continues to shrink, and that's something that only got worse in the economic recession as well, with demand increasing and supply further receding. So a huge crisis, and why I will always be a civil legal aid lawyer at heart.
And I feel like the interview with Matt Desmond pointed out that the stakes are just so high with this. You know, we don't provide lawyers because, it's a civil case. But with, you know, his book Evicted and just the crisis in general, it shows that people can get trapped in poverty because of, you know, these sorts of cases. So the fact that it's kind of dismissed or seen as, these are civil cases, they don't have a constitutional right to a lawyer, is just, it's sad, because the stakes are as high as with criminal cases or other cases.
Well, yeah, of course, even having a constitutional right to a lawyer in criminal cases doesn't solve the problem either.
Right,
that's another situation we've talked about repeatedly on this show, is the crisis that we have in public defense because of massive underfunding.
Yeah, the stuff going on in Louisiana in particular is just insane. People sitting in a cell for
years waiting for their day in court because there aren't
PD to be available.
Yeah. Exactly right.
So the thing that drives me crazy about this, or well, that I think is really important and interesting about these kinds of statistics, is we often, I think, especially in D.C. and in sort of journalism and media, we talk about whether or not the American ideal of economic mobility and social mobility is sort of receding or fading, or whether we're actually living up to that vision of what this country is. But we usually talk about that in really abstracted terms, in statistics about income levels and generational shifts in wealth and where people are in the income distribution, wealth distribution relative to their parents' generation, things like that. And this is sort of, as I think you were both sort of getting at, this is the process by which those things, those ideals break down.
Right.
There are a bunch of rooms in which people should have an opportunity to vindicate their own eligibility for that kind of upward mobility. And they don't get to, in part because we just don't bother to make that not just easy, we don't even make it really possible.
So we end up with a two-tiered system of justice where if you can afford a lawyer, then great, you're lucky. And if you can't, then either the courthouse doors are entirely closed to you or you just can't access any sort of justice or fairness at all in a system, whether it's public assistance or housing or anything.
Yeah, and it becomes more like Judge Judy than like, you know, a sophisticated, thoughtful legal process.
So keep us moving, Tracy.
Well, no offense
I can talk
to
about
Judge
this all
Judy.
Day.
No, Judge Judy is great. The idea that we would adjudicate people's lives and livelihood.
Adjudicate?
All right, what's the next story?
You should cut that.
What's the next story?
All right, in Akron, Ohio, the city is violating homeless people's First Amendment rights by threatening to arrest any panhandler who doesn't first register with the city and have their personal story fact-checked by city workers.
Wait.
I'm sorry. What?
So
it was a long time. I can read it again. It's a very long
time. Wait, where is this?
Akron, Ohio.
And register as
Akron.
What? Like a sole proprietor? Or like what?
No, like you don't have to get a business.
Panhandler.
It's sort of. It's not making people get a business license, but you have to go and get a photo ID and get sort of certified by the city legitimately whatever.
We're not even going to let you finish telling the story.
I have so much other.
You know what? I just have to say, this is like John Stossel of Fox News became mayor of Akron, Ohio, and I missed it because this would be first on his list is to deal with all those homeless people, right?
Does he really call them foamless?
Remember? No, I just made that up.
She made that up.
Okay.
All
right.
It seemed fitting.
Because they probably don't own any foam.
Remember,
that's probably true.
That's a good point. Foamless. It has
one
many
does not simply
here,
but anyway, walk into Mordor and get a latte.
This is his MO, exposing the fake homeless people out there.
Yes.
Anyway, continue. This
Sorry.
Is already we
all
already,
right, so
we're
already outraged.
One sentence in and we're outraged.
Well, and that whole sentence was all according to an ACLU lawsuit against the Rubber City. The group is hoping to knock down a longstanding restriction on asking for money on the streets of Akron. And so set aside that sort of Kafkaesque process that we're talking about of like putting destitute people through a vetting process and getting them IDs printed and all that kludgy bureaucratic
registered
crap.
Panhandlers.
This is also at root. It's also a conscious decision to spend time and money regulating the panhandling industry.
Instead of it's an industry. Sorry. The panhandling, industrial complex.
The customer must be protected.
Big panhandle needs to be brought to justice.
Yeah, these abuses in the panhandling industry, these poor customers of the panhandle.
Keep going.
And we're doing all of that instead of dedicating those same time and money and energy resources and staff resources to, I don't know, combating the actual roots of homelessness and poverty.
This is amazing.
It's just so ridiculous that I feel like
we can't even say anything
anything logical or intelligent, because it's just all the holes are obvious. Exactly like you said, they could be putting time and energy into figuring out their workforce development system, substance abuse. There's just all kinds of wraparound services, housing first programs. Every homeless program that we've mentioned on this show is something that this city should be putting time and energy into instead of cracking down on this is just
weird.
Well,
and also sorry, John Stossel, but the thought that anyone would possibly take to the streets and beg for money if they had any reasonable alternative is just crazy, right? It just is. It's people who have no other alternative and are desperate and are trying to get something to eat and aren't even able to think about tomorrow or where they might even sleep. That's the level of Maslow's hierarchy that we're talking about. And so to put them through a I can't even.
Yeah, this is always the conservative steps of trying to go after the fraud that is actually minuscule, you know, whether it's drug testing people for benefits.
As if there could be fraud in panhandling. Right? Let's not even grant them the friggin' premise here.
I know.
It's to villainize, it's to otherize, it's to make them look like it's, you know, bad choices and personal.
Is this a Republican or Democratic administration?
The city of Akron. I don't know.
It's still conservative ideals.
They've had a panhandling law on the books that I think a lot of places have laws that make it not necessarily criminal, but illegal to panhandle specifically near roadways, and they justify that as
attractions or whatever.
Right, mm-hmm. right. And often they're justified as public safety mm-hmm. measures. They don't want people getting hit by cars, mm-hmm. things like that. Mm-hmm. But Akron, I think about 4 years ago, if I remember right, maybe six, they amended this longstanding sort of basic panhandling sort of public safety law to include this registration process, this sort of tag 'em and bag 'em thing.
All right. What's the next story?
Okay, I'm gonna everybody just, take a breath.
Yeah,
everybody
we're like ready? Exhausted ready? From that one.
This is
so bizarre.
Oh wait, we have to be fair. It's a Democratic mayor.
Yep. Well
there
it's
you go.
Conservative
so,
ideology. Not all Dems are great.
Well,
so.
and homelessness, bad homelessness policy is almost always done in response to local pressure from
yep.
some That's person right. who calls
yeah.
your office
Regardless
six times
of
a week
party.
Saying, "I
bad
saw
policies.
A guy so, who didn't smell good and I, had a weird beard, and you should do the things."
Great impersonation.
That was great. That was great.
Take it on the road.
I'm gonna make a promise that we're gonna come back to this on a future episode
yeah.
because we're gonna need to dig in deeper on this right. one. This one
All
is
right.
that bad.
All right. Now, what's the final one?
Okay. Nobody throw things at me. I'm just the messenger here.
All right.
George Zimmerman is auctioning off the gun he used to kill Trayvon Martin because apparently that's the country we live in. It's the United States of America where you can pick a fight with somebody who's on his way home just because your racist ass is pretty sure he's a crook and then kill him when you start losing that fight
yeah.
and then not go to jail for murder and then make money off the weapon you used to kill him.
Right. Yeah. This I saw his name trending. I was hoping it was that he was finally arrested for one of the many things that he has continuously done wrong over the
Why
past several
years. Why
would
you possibly think that that was actually going to happen?
You know what? Because apparently I'm an idealist at heart, but this is just, it's sickening. It really, I
and
feel like...
Because people are going to bid on this gun.
I know,
people
and that's
going
the thing,
to
is someone's going
to
get
this
it.
Gun.
And I feel like it's, it. My, I don't know, I'm starting to feel just almost jittery talking about this. It makes me so furious that he realizes there's a celebrity
right.
status that he has, and the fact that also the press continues to cover him in Goldie Taylor from Daily Beast tweeted out, you know, it was like pulling teeth to get the press to report on him after
right.
he actually murdered Trayvon Martin. And now every time he just like, you know, does any kind of stunt, he's, you know, on the front page of every story. And it's just, it's so frustrating.
It's clickbait.
It's
total
clickbait.
That's what this is, and he's playing right into it.
He knows it's the only way that he's relevant and can get money and whatever. And I just, he's trash.
We should add that there were some reports right after that news broke that the gun broker had actually decided to cancel the sale of the weapon that Zimmerman had used to kill Trayvon Martin. So we'll see how this plays out in the days to come. But it doesn't.
And however it plays out, America will continue to be a horrifyingly racist and violent and
yeah.
hostile place for anyone who's not white.
Yeah, it's disgusting. That's the weekly worst for me. Because it's just disgusting. I think I would have voted for the Akron one because it's so stupid, but yeah. Zimmerman is, I think, just the worst of the century for me. He'll be every worst, weekly worst for me.
Well, so, Alan, I'm going to have to take back every nice thing I said about how much I loved your pandering to me, because what you actually did was to give me an impossible choice between my heart as a legal aid lawyer, this panhandling case, which is just horrible, and George Zimmerman. And I can't vote against the George Zimmerman situation because it is as vile as it is. So there. Sorry, legal aid.
I'm not sorry, legal aid. I am with you guys.
Yeah.
This time we're actually unanimous here. And
Woo!
And for me, it's both because, holy crap, George Zimmerman is
yeah.
awful, and because I'm pretty sure that he's going to get well more than the $5,000 that he's set
right.
as the reserve price for this gun. Assuming, as you pointed out, that it actually goes through as an auction. But the appetite that this stuff unleashes. And you're right that the media coverage can often be irresponsible. And there's this asymmetry to
mm-hmm.
how eager people are to cover something when it's actually happened to a child. And then how obsessed we become once folks realize, oh, there's actually a lot of traffic in
right.
this after the fact. But I think that's also reflective. I mean, there's a bunch going on there. But one thing that reflects is how whatever the opposite of unique is, George Zimmerman is, how there's this whole cast of people, tens and tens of millions of Americans who eagerly laud people like this as heroic and view them as somehow championing an order or a set of standards that they think is now lacking in this country. And it's just it's appalling to me to share a democracy with those people and to know
yeah.
that they get the same number of votes that I do about what this country looks like. And it's disgusting.
I'm going to close on a note of an analogy that I never thought I would have to make, but similar to how states can rest easy knowing, well, at least there's Mississippi. I feel like George Zimmerman gets to rest easy knowing, well, at least there's Ted Cruz.
Oh,
there's someone
I don't know.
Less likable than he is.
That's a toss up. But I'll just say that, you know, if one good thing can emerge from this weekly worst is that we will continue to advocate for legal aid lawyers, and we'll do some more coverage on that, as well as that Akron story. So thanks for bringing those up, even though you brought us down with that last story. But we'll have you back on the weekly-ish or soon.
Excellent. I look forward to it.
And that's our show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio, broadcasting from the heart of Anacostia in Washington, D.C. You can catch us weekends at 11 a.m. on the WEACT Radio Network. You can also catch us Saturdays, 11 a.m., and Sundays at 10 a.m. on the Progressive Voices Network via the TuneIn app.
You can also subscribe to Talk Poverty Radio as a podcast via iTunes. And feel free to pitch us on Twitter at the handle @TalkPoverty or email us at info@talkpoverty.org. See you next week.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clocks by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And underdogs could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom. What we talking about?